I'm not Mark. I am Melissa Miller Sears' father. When you start having children, your identity changes, and you become somebody else's something. I want to begin this morning by expressing to you my sincere and deep gratitude for this church. Not just because you opened the doors and permitted us to do some thinking out loud together about some really difficult challenges, like living with loss and all of that entails. It was a wonderful experience. Friday morning, Friday evening, Saturday morning, I personally grew tremendously from the experience, and I learned from some of the interaction that I had with those who attended our Living with Loss workshop. I'm thankful that this church permitted us the opportunity to think out loud together about those tough issues. But I have a deeper sense of gratitude for this church that really is kind of hard to put in words, but I'm going to try. I've known this church for a little over 20 years. Our daughter chose to come here for her graduate school after graduating from Fried Hardeman University. She came here as a 21-year-old. And she came here with a dear friend of our family, Rebecca Schinholzer. Thank you, Donnie, and the college ministry for all that you did to impact the life of my daughter. Not only that, but when my daughter started dating this guy that she met while she was doing some internships, you helped her introduce him to Jesus and his church. And he became a Christian. My son-in-law is a Christian because of my daughter in this church. I want to thank you, too, for providing a very healthy spiritual atmosphere for my grandchildren. I know if you have grandchildren, you know how precious that they are. Thank you for being such a blessing to my grandchildren, Evan and Brooklyn. I so deeply appreciate this church. I'm really proud of this church. And I pray that we will continue to grow together. I'm sure periodically I'll have a chance to come here and visit some more. Could I ask you to turn this morning to the book of Job? And while you're turning to the book of Job, I would like to ask you if you remember about who wants to be a millionaire. I mean, who doesn't want to be a millionaire? Remember Regis Philbin, 1999? That was when it appeared August of 1999 in our country. It originated as a British show. It has been highly acclaimed. As a matter of fact, it is one of the highest rated game shows in the history of U.S. television. I remember when it came on, and I remember how it captured the attention of so many households. And it really was an interesting game show. If you remember anything about that game show, you remember there were questions, and there were different levels of difficulty in regard to those questions. I think I enjoyed most the phone a friend option. They could be crazy sometimes when they needed assistance. But then there was, if you were able to get to the highest level, there was then the crowning jewel of all questions, the million-dollar question. There were 12 people in the history of that show that answered that million-dollar question and walked away with the biggest prize of any game show. Why do we suffer so? Why do we experience loss? Why do we deal with the struggles that we deal with in this world? Where Jesus said in John 16:33, in this world you will have tribulations. But why? And why me? And when it's you, why you? I think in our culture, this is really perceived to be the million-dollar question. This is the one that we want the answer to. The question why. In the book of Job, which is a book that is often known as a book about the problem of human suffering, there is a man. As a matter of fact, he's introduced right at the start. He's a patriarch, a contemporary maybe of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob possibly. But pretty obviously, some patriarchal individual. But he wasn't a common, ordinary Joe. As a matter of fact, look there at verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz. Uz, not Oz. This is not the Wizard of Oz. This is not mystical, fanciful. This is real. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And notice what it says of him. He was blameless, upright, one that feared God and shunned evil. To say that he was a good person is really not to commend him highly enough. And as a matter of fact, this is not just how he was known by others. This was how he really was. This wasn't his reputation, this was his character. He was an awesome guy. He wasn't just awesome in the sense that maybe human beings would think of other human beings as awesome because we're close with them. He was a man who was deeply devoted to God. Blameless, upright, feared God, shunned evil. He was richly blessed. He had 10 kids. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. He was a rich man. Look at verse 3. Also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Why do even the best of people suffer? We really struggle with that question. We put a lot of emphasis on our felt need to know the answer to that question. Why is it that people suffer? Now, let's be honest about it. We do not have a problem with the miserable heathen of this world suffering. Let's be honest about it. We don't. I mean, you get what you deserve. You know, that's kind of how we roll sometimes in our world. We can rationalize bad people suffering. But we're not talking here in this story about bad people suffering. We're talking about the best of people suffering. Because those 10 kids, he loses not one or two of them, not half of them, but all of them. And those possessions, he lost all of those too. If you continue to read the story, things get so bad that it's obvious he loses the support of his wife. At least he had a wife. She may not have been the best. But even she cracked. But let's cut that woman some slack. That woman bore 10 children. She went through the labor and travail of giving birth to those 10 children. And you know what? She lost those 10 children too. Wasn't just Job. She lost them too. Really think about not just the suffering of Job. Think about the suffering of his wife. Her life tanked too. Some of you in this big room have lost children. I have not and hope I never do. The unimaginable experience of losing a child is just beyond my ability to comprehend. But Job and his wife lost all 10 children. He lost all of those critters. So he's wiped out. And then as you continue to read the story, he becomes afflicted physically with these boils from the top of his head to the very bottom of his feet. And he's suffering physically as well. There's this debate that goes on as you read the book. There's this debate goes on in the unseen world. where Satan says, Lord, the reason why he is so good to you is you've been kissing up to him all of his life. You build a hedge around him and you're pouring blessings in. And Lord, what in the world do you expect? If you keep kissing up to him like that, he's going to continue to hug you and love you and serve you and honor you. Satan said, if you mess with him, I'll bet he won't be like that. God believed in the character of Job. God knew the character of Job. Satan questioned the character of Job and his integrity. And God said, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to mess with him, but if you want to mess with him, you go right ahead. But God's going to draw the lines, and Satan is going to have to color inside the lines. Because the Lord said, you go ahead and mess with him, but don't you dare touch him. Mess with his stuff. And that's why he lost all those children. And that's why he lost all of his prosperity. Satan began attacking him and destroying his life. Well, then Satan wasn't still convinced. Said, you know, the problem, Lord, is you need to touch him. You need to mess with him personally, his physical body. The Lord said, I ain't doing it. If you want to do it, go right ahead. But don't you dare kill him. God, again, was in control. The book of Job isn't just a book about the problem of human suffering. It's a book about the sovereignty of God. God is on the throne and God is ultimately in control. And in that, we ought to take great comfort. Well, Satan does afflict him with those physical ailments I described in regard to his skin. Can you imagine aching and struggling so much that you take a potsherd, a broken piece of pottery, and scrape your skin for some sort of a relief? He got to being so bad off as far as his physical condition when he had three friends come to him. They didn't even recognize him. His appearance had even changed. A great man of God suffered tremendously. And you know what? This great man of God had a lot of questions. And I really wish that in the book of Job, you'd read more than just the first couple of chapters. Between chapter 3 and chapter 41, there's a lot of great stuff there. As a matter of fact, there is an academic literature expert who one time observed, if all the writings of men were ever destroyed, he said, save the book of Job. But Job was really shook by what he experienced. He was a great man of God. The operative word there, man. He's of God, but he's a man, and he's struggling. I want you to notice in chapter 3 and verse 11 to begin with. Why did I not die at birth? There's a why question. Now, how does this question come up? Why in the world does this question come up? Well, this question comes up because of his life circumstances. So he says, why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came out of the womb? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breast that I should nurse? Why? Look at verse 20 of the same chapter. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul? Look at verse 23 of the same chapter. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? He keeps asking the question, why? If you flip over to chapter 10, in Job chapter 10 and verse 18, he says, why then have you brought me out of the womb? Oh, that I had perished and no eye had seen me. Now, we might expect a person who had a weak faith to have a lot of why questions, but this is not a man of weak faith. This is a man of deep devotion, a man who is deeply devoted to God. He's suffering tremendously, and he is really struggling with a lot of why questions that are going on between his ears and inside of his heart. His thinker and his feeler are really struggling, and they're not on the same page. He knows his heart. He knows his devotion to God. He knows God. He loves God. But even in his thinking, as you read through the book, in his thinking, the Lord is doing this to him. And he's just kind of sucking it up. He's just trying to survive every hour and every day going through this agony of all of these losses that he's experiencing. And in his agony, he asks a lot of why questions. Gideon did the same thing in Judges chapter 6. In Judges chapter 6, the Midianites had been oppressing the Israelites, and for good reason. It was by divine design, it was by providence, that God wanted to punish and discipline his children because of their unfaithfulness. So they are permitted to enjoy what is described in Judges chapter 6 as a great deal of poverty. And then an angel appears to Gideon and says, "Gideon, giddy up, man of valor, the Lord is with you." And he says, "Whoa, if the Lord is with us, why has all of this happened to us?" He wasn't a heathen, he was a judge. He was a deliverer of Israel, a man of God. And he's asking, if the Lord's with us, why in the world are we experiencing what we're experiencing? See, he's struggling with that why question, that so-called million-dollar question. Jeremiah was a great prophet. He prophesied for over four decades. That man experienced horrific persecution. The abuse and the rejection that Jeremiah experienced for year after year and decade after decade, and yet he was a faithful servant of God, a great man of faith that God used. And yet, if you look in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 20, verse 18, he asked the question, "Why in the world did you let me be born? Why?" And then you think about the cross that we were just reflecting about. Think about that cross. My God, why even Jesus? Why have you forsaken me? I share that with us this morning to help us reflect on the fact that great people of God, not just average ordinary Joes or Josephines, but great men of God, struggled with the heartaches of life to the degree that they would struggle with the why questions that come in to the heart and the head of human beings. Is it okay to ask why? Well, evidently it is. Jesus did. However, I want you to stop and think about something. We are a strange breed, us human beings. Now, when adversity is what we're experiencing, we're real quick to ask why. What about when you get your dream job or you get accepted to the university that you just loved and dreamed of being able to do your graduate work in? Do you ask why then? When you get a big raise, do you ask why then? Why me, Lord? When you have a child born like Evan was at Shands Hospital, it really was Shands Hospital back then, or when Brooklyn was born at North Florida Regional, why me, Lord? See, we ask why when things are bad. You know, a really good time to ask why, an even better time to ask why, is when you're blessed. Because we're blessed beyond measure, we're blessed beyond merit. We could not possibly literally count our blessings. No way. We're super blessed, all of us. We are all way more blessed than we're burdened. When do we ever ask why we are so richly blessed? We're so undeserving of our blessings. That's just a footnote to our study. But it's okay to ask the question why. But we need to realize the fact is we may never know. One of the greatest feats, and I love this quote from H. Norman Wright, one of the greatest feats of life is learning to live without answers. I know, we sing that song. We'll understand it later, by and by. Here's my theory. By the way, I don't sing that section of that song. I just can't do it. But I understand a way that you could, with the liberty of lyrics and poetry and all that sort of thing, I understand that it could be done that way. You could sing that and be sincere about it. But here's my theory. When we get to heaven, I don't think we're going to have any questions. We're going to be so blown away by being in the magnificence and the glory and the majesty of God, ain't nothing else going to matter. Our God is an awesome God. And to be able to be in His presence, whoa, what else would you think of? I'm not so sure the why question is going to matter on the other side. Brother Charles Hodge used to write the last page of the Gospel Advocate for a number of years, and he made this observation one time: faith does not give us the answers. I maybe should add to that, doesn't always give us the answers. Faith allows us to live without answers. There are things this side of eternity we'll never know about. We'll never be able to understand. God does work in mysterious ways. And sometimes, though, we just seem obsessed with the question, why? Well, finally, after Job struggles verbally, his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, struggle with these issues, and they debate these issues, and the Lord lets them do it, go on and on and on. In chapter 38, finally, God steps in, and he says something. Chapter 38, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me." See, Job has had all these questions that he's been talking about since chapter 3. And now, God says, okay, you sit over there on that log. And how about let me ask you some questions? You've been asking a bunch of questions. How about you sit there, and I'll ask you some questions? And so God starts. "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer. Were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what and where were its foundations fashioned? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut the sea with the doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set the bars and doors, when I said, 'This is how far you can come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop.'" He keeps asking him rhetorical questions, rapid fire questions. It goes on and on and on, these rapid fire questions. And let me summarize for you what the Lord is doing with Job. He's saying, "Okay, Job, let me ask you a bunch of questions." He bonfires him with a bunch of questions that blow him away. And here's a Cliff's Notes version, commentary on what God tells him. "Job, how about let me be God and you be Job? Deal or no deal? God is God, and we are just his creation. existing in his image and after his likeness. We don't have all the answers. God knows all the answers. We don't have to have all the answers. But I want to suggest to you that with all the questions that we ask when we're struggling with our life and our life circumstances, with all the questions, and there's a lot of them, and we typically think of the why question as the million-dollar question, and we think that if we know the answer to that question, some way, somehow, things are going to be easier, things are going to be better because we understand. I don't think that's true, but that's how messed up we can be in our heads sometimes when we're struggling. Even if you know the answer to the question why, you still got to deal with it. I think there's a more important question. I think this is the million-dollar question. This is the million-dollar question. Who? And that's what God was doing with Job. Job, I'll be God, you be you. You're not me. I'm God. Whenever you're struggling with your life, who knows more about that struggle than anybody else? Who knows what's going on inside of your head and what's going on inside of your heart more than anybody else? Who can provide for you everything that you need, no matter how difficult life has become for you? That's the million-dollar question. Who? And the answer is always God. If we know the who, we can survive the what no matter why. If we know the who. Wait on the Lord. Be of good courage. What can he do? He can strengthen your heart. And then the Hobby Lobby verse in the Bible. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. Renew. Change is the idea. Change their strength. Swap their pitiful weakness for the strength that God provides. The context of that passage is important, and we'll close with this. I know that passage is a favorite passage of many people. You can find it on a lot of home interior products, but I think we miss the boat if we don't look at the context. Before that verse, I want to start at verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall utterly fall. But, see, there's the context. Don't divorce the last verse of the chapter from what's previous to that last verse. But, despite the fact our understanding is limited, our strength is feeble, there is somebody who knows and who cares and who will help us with everything that we deal with in life. And that's what's important. The who that knows and can be the best of help to us. If we access him, if we choose to rely on him and trust in him, those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They're the ones that'll mount up with wings like eagles. They'll run and not be weary and walk and not be faint. Do you know what we need most when we're at our worst? It's the same thing we need when we're at our best. It's the Lord. Edwin White wrote a book called A Sense of Presence, and in that book he made this observation. When you reduce life to its essentials, there is only one thing that's needful. To have God. He's right. The one essential thing in life is to have God. If we have God, that's all we need. Because that loving, caring Father in heaven will make sure that we'll have everything else along the way until we are embraced by him in eternity. If you're struggling with something this morning that's really difficult and you need the prayers of this church, feel free to be transparent and share that. Sometimes the reason why we don't get the support and encouragement that we should is because other people who love us don't even know what's going on with us. If you need the prayers of this church and the support and encouragement following this morning, you feel free to come and share that. If you're not yet a Christian and you'd like to begin waiting on the Lord, the place to begin is at the cross. And if you, with a simple trusting faith, have a genuine sense of penitence and want to follow Jesus the rest of your life, we give you the opportunity to come, and even this morning you can be baptized into Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins and begin a new walk with him. Nobody deserves it, the new beginning, but everybody can have it. If you need it, and you do, whether we realize it or not, we need it. We want you to feel free to accept it. You come this morning if you'd like to. Take a front seat while we stand and while we sing.